All right, we'd like to welcome everyone out tonight to our May RAC meeting. Appreciate the RAC members and making it tonight. We'd also like to welcome the public and our division employees. We'll start off with approval of our agenda and our minutes. Has everyone had an opportunity to take a look at those? And
move to approve.
Okay. Motion by Todd Huntington to approve the agenda and the minutes.
Second.
Okay. Seconded by Chris Meekles. All in favor? Unanimous.
My backup's on the wrong side of the room.
You'll have to.
Intimidated. He was in that uniform.
Oh. This is the last time you get him as a backup.
Oh, really? Oh, man. Okay. Bring my gun all the time.
So our last Wildlife Board meeting was pretty eventful, and I'll do my best to update you and maybe have Chris jump in here also. But I'll start off with some of the notes from our director. He talked about the wolf management was restored back to Wyoming. So now that will be back under state management in Wyoming. So now Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming have management of the state management of the wolf. He reiterated the tough winter that they had in northern parts of the state. They may have had up to 90% fawn loss in some areas of the northern part of the state. Talked about the winter feeding, and he really appreciated a lot of those who stepped up to help with that, a lot of public and groups helped with that, and he appreciated that. He talked about the shed antler season and why some of the reasons why they did what they did with that. They had a 60-day closure. He said that officers spent 3,200 hours during that at 2,500 contacts, and there was 93 violations during that time. There was a motion right off the start. They had an action log item that the division review the shed antler gathering and provide an informational report at the upcoming September RAC meeting. And that motion was unanimous. There was...
For what? What are they going to...
So the division's going to look at all the pros and cons of the shed antler season, kind of how it developed. They talked about it pretty in-depth in the meeting. There was a lot of other effects from that they weren't necessarily considering, the effects it had on Colorado, on Arizona, on Nevada. Some of those states had to implement their own shed antler seasons due to that, or Colorado did at least. And so they wanted the division to come back with more feedback on exactly what happened, and if they were to do it in the future, what that may mean, and help the Wildlife Board to make a decision on if they want that to go around to the racks or not.
Headed towards like a permanent season, there a permanent opening?
Right now it's just in the review, so it's action log. They want the division to bring to light all of those things to be able to be discussed, and the board would make a decision whether that would come through the RAC process or just only be during emergency years. So,
just some internal talks from what I've heard is that if it was up to us, I think we would, as an agency, would be leaning towards not having this type of thing in the future, unless there was a severe winter. But of course, it would have to go through the RAC and board processes.
Right. Yeah, that's a lot of man hours that you had to spend putting towards that. A lot of violations, too, unfortunately.
The Bucks Bowls once in a lifetime. This is my first time since attending the Wildlife Board that I've ever seen that pass unanimous, and that was the case. Also, the antlerless permit numbers was also passed unanimous.
We just had to fine tune it for him. That's all.
That's right.
Should I talk about that one?
So there was the variance that came through with the with that landowner. There was a lot of discussion there. There's quite a lot more in-depth. The landowners were there, and they talked a lot about in-depth. Just to review that a little bit, that's where the land that was threatened to be condemned, and then they the landowner sold it off. So with much discussion, the Wildlife Board did approve them to have a CWMU, different than us.
I think the Wildlife Board felt like they were giving a variance, they granted the variance, right? But I think one of our thoughts was, or your thoughts were, that if we approve this, we'll have a line of people waiting to get theirs approved as well. I think the Wildlife Board decided that this is such a specific situation where the federal government said we're going to either sell us your land or we're going to condemn your land, and they had to sell their land to the federal government, and that's what created this gap between their two properties. That was such an exception that they're not going to see a line of people wanting a variance in the future for that reason. Is that right?
There were several action logs. There was one action log request that the division look at the possibility of a second general season rifle deer hunt. This was one that we also had brought from ours, and that passed unanimous. There was an action log request to have the division look at the possibility of limited entry late muzzleloader hunts on general season units with buck to doe ratios at or above the objective. And so that's happening on some units, but they, as an action log, wanted it to all units that were above their above the management objective. So that would be an action log to the division. I wish that we could ask for the division to come down. They give a presentation there on what they had found on the cactus buck, findings on the Ponsagant from their study down there. Fortunately, the level of intelligence it takes to understand that's a lot above what I can describe it to you. But it was a very good study. I don't know if we could have that presented. But there was some really good information there, and so there was a action log item to have the division looking at adding a velvet only buck hunt in November on the Ponsagant hunt that may address some of that, but that's at this time just an action log for the division to look at the pros and cons of that.
It's impossible to define cactus buck, so in order to try to help define cactus buck, it was called a velvet-only buck hunt. So if it's still in the velvet in November, it has hormonally, it's classified. It's a cactus buck.
Yeah. So they would ask the division to look at the possibility, but that hunt would not be allowed to be during the muzzleloader or the archery like the Henrys has. So. Then they also asked the division to look at now that the mountain goat issue seems to have been solved, some of the lawsuits, that they asked the division to go forward at looking at the rest of the areas that they wanted to pursue that as an action log item and see if they're going to move forward with those. Um, There was also an action log to request to have the division look at ending all antlerless public hunts by December 31st. Do you have it that passed?
I assume you did, yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Any questions? Quite a bit there from that meeting, so.
Yeah, some of these action log items are from an outgoing board member or some of the outgoing board members who wanted to, you know, their last term was coming up in June and they wanted to see some things, have the division do some things in the upcoming years. And so that's why you saw a long list of action log items.
With that, we'll turn the time over to Chris for regional update.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. Maybe first we should have Dana introduce herself, because we have a new RAC member. We said goodbye to Carl last week. So maybe, Dana, introduce yourself and background and interest, and yeah, it'd be great.
Well, my name's Dana Truman. I work out of the BLM in Price, Utah. I work as their wildlife biologist and botanist, so I spend a lot of time working on endangered plants, vegetation, and the local wildlife. I worked as a range specialist for them for about 7 years before this, and then I also spent 2 years at the Forest Service at Manti La Salle. So I really enjoy public land management, and I'm a big fan of our public lands and the hunting opportunities.
Awesome. Any questions for Dana? Okay, welcome aboard. We have Carl left last month, and then we have 6 additional RAC members leaving after tonight. And so before I go into the regional update, maybe I'll just thank you for your service. It's a lot of time and effort. So we have Darius and Chris and Kevin and Todd and Charlie and Blair Eastman and Carl left last time. So we're replacing 7 of you are leaving us, I guess. You've served for 8 years, I believe, all of you. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of hours. It's a lot of miles. So thank you for representing the groups that you did and for taking all the time and effort to reading all the packets that you got each month and reading all the emails and phone calls and people from the public telling you their opinion and coming to this meeting and expressing those viewpoints. I've only been a part of the RAC process in our region. My previous position didn't, I wasn't required to come to this meeting, so I didn't come most times. But in the last 4 years, I think about the things that you guys have tackled, from mountain goats to the crow hunt to whether you can use corn or not. There's always opinions on cougars and bears and deer, all these complicated, complex, sometimes controversial issues that you have tackled and read and researched and then come to this meeting and compromised and made motions that have carried forward to the board. And Kevin and I was talking about this in the last few weeks. We have appreciated and the board who every single meeting take each individual motion of each individual RAC and consider it when they make their decisions. So I want you to know that your recommendations and your motions made a difference and it got considered. Of course, there's 5 different RACs, so not every motion you get is going to be everyone's going to agree with, and it's going to be part of the actual action that gets passed. But we certainly thank you for all of your service. I brought cake tonight, so after the meeting tonight we can have cake and punch over here. Also against this wall you can see we have some framed prints. In a tradition of DWR, we give each outgoing RAC member a framed print. And so I knew what a few of you liked. Todd and Kevin, I think your prints are the bighorn sheep if you want those. There's 2 of them there. Darius, yours is the bobcat. Charlie and Chris, you can pick whichever ones you want left. We have a deer and elk, and then we have also 3 framed prints of the San Rafael Swell that a local photographer took, and we've had professionally framed. So choice is yours. You guys want to switch at the end, too? That's fine as well. Thank you for your service. This little framed print is the least that we could do to show our appreciation. Our agency appreciates it, and I'm sure the public and those you represent appreciate all your hard work and service. So thank you. We are in the process of interviewing new RAC members, so we'll have We have Dana, and then we'll have six new RAC members coming in at the next meeting. And Kevin and myself and Morgan have interviewed those people over the last month, and we have some great RAC members coming up. They're not going to be able to replace you guys quite as well, but big shoes to fill. But they'll try.
Daryl will keep them in line.
Yeah. Yes. And what I'm really proud about our RAC is I think it represents southeastern Utah. I think it's a diverse group of people. And I think if you think about who lives in southeastern Utah, you can kind of look at RAC members and say, yeah, I think we're represented pretty proportionally of what kind of people live in this area. And I think that's a compliment to Bill and Kevin and Darius who helped pick the current RAC. So, all right, our regional update. Our aquatics crew has been busy. We hosted a Boy Scout group on April 22nd at the Carbon County Pond. I think there were several hundred of them that came to Price for the weekend, had to have a training, and part of that was taking them fishing at the Carbon County Pond. And then the last week and through the end of the month, we'll be doing gill netting at numerous reservoirs throughout, I guess, mostly Carbon and Emery County, but I guess there's Lloyd's Lake in San Juan County. But if you're interested in going to any of those, let me know. I'll tell you the times. But as you probably remember, that's a survey that we do in order to get an idea of the species composition, how big the fish are growing, and whether our management strategies are working or not. We put out a net or several nets, four or five nets throughout the reservoir. The next day we come back and pull the nets, and we measure, weigh, and document all the fish that we catch in our nets. So it's a good hands-on experience with wildlife, and you're all invited to help us with that. The wildlife section is also doing some bird surveys on Olson Reservoir. Dan Keller's the lead on that project, which is why it's under aquatics. He's our native aquatics biologist. He's creating a wetland. Maybe, Dana, maybe you're part of that project too. A better wetland at Olson Reservoir, right? And that's part of that. Our habitat crew, we have restoration projects going on this spring as well. There's been some tamarisk removal at Gordon Creek. We hired a crew to do that. Pinyon juniper removal on the northeast LaSalle's. That just started. And then on several of our wildlife management areas, including Gordon Creek and Nash Wash and Desert Lake, we have some fields that we irrigate and plant. And we have water rights in those drainages in order to maintain those water rights, improve upon them, and also create habitat. We do some farming here and there. And then in the next few weeks, we'll be installing five new chukar guzzlers near Hiawatha and Huntington. Our conservation officers have been busy. We have an event this Saturday, actually, at the Carbon County Fairgrounds. It's called Cops, Badges, and Bobbers, or something like that. Cops, Badges, and Bobbers? Anyways, we invite the community to come out. We'll feed them hot dogs and chips and soda pop, and they can go fish with the conservation officer. We teamed up with the local sheriff's office as well. Inside the Carbon County Event Center, we'll also have an archery shoot where kids can shoot archery at targets and learn about wildlife. We're starting our aquatic invasive species, our AIS checkpoints at Lake Powell, and we're hiring a bunch of seasonals for them to work the local reservoirs and work at Lake Powell. That's beginning now. We just had a big meeting in March, or was it April? It was April. We had a big meeting in April, a statewide meeting. And part of that meeting was we gave out some awards. And so some of our officers got honored at that awards ceremony. Roger Kirkstetter, you're probably thinking, he really is the officer of the year? Roger's not here. But Roger's known as the rain cloud. He kind of can have a bad attitude sometimes. But he's a great officer. He's very well respected among his colleagues. He's a 20, 25-year veteran of our agency. Trains these officers. They respect him. He's the go-to guy when they have a question, and so it was nice to honor him. J.D. Abbott. Did I see J.D.? Is he here? No. He's not here. He got our Damn Good Job Award. Our Ben Stearns in our region got the Trainer of the Year, and then as a unit, all of our officers together got the Manti Saturation. They got the Citation Award because of their work on the Manti Saturation Patrol, which happened last summer. So our officers all got together last summer, and or I think the entire weekend, saturated the manti and did a lot of education and some citation writing as well. We're looking to hire new officers. We're in the process. And so those interviews start on May 20th. I think there's another batch going through. So we have several openings throughout our region and throughout the state. We're hoping to fill those agencies in the next year. And then our outreach guys, Morgan and Walt, they're helping the various sections. They're also helping host this Cops, Badges, and Bobbers event. There's something called Conservation Days happening May 16th to the 18th. That's in Emory County. I believe it's some school kids. Yeah, school kids, fourth graders come and for 2 days learn about conservation, and so we're teaming with the Forest Service to do that. We have a clinic on May 20th in Price. It's called Gals and Guns. We did this event 18 months ago, and it was a big success. Sometimes when men are around and we have clinics for the general public, men tend to dominate the clinic, and we've learned that women want their own event, and they feel safe, and they feel like men aren't trying to teach them things they already know, and so it's a good, safe environment for them to come and learn the basics of shooting. And we attract sportsmen. We attract people who are more into it from the personal safety standpoint of it. But we usually get about 30 women together, and they teach a class in the morning, and they go out to the shooting range in the afternoon and learn, get some hands-on experience. So that clinic's a RSVP type clinic. So if you're interested, let Morgan know, and he can sign you up. And then we have a big statewide event called the Outdoor Adventure Days that's coming up in June that some of us will be working at as well. Our wildlife section, they've just finished deer spring classifications. They're also teaming up with the habitat section this month and with the federal land managers and going over the winter range and seeing what the sagebrush looks like and what the range conditions look like and counting any more deer mortality and elk mortality that they might see. And then doing pellet group transects as well. We're currently teaming up with our partners to do eagle nest surveys, and then we've been capturing some sage grouse with USU and with their researchers, and doing some work in Emma Park as well. And I'll take any questions that you might have. Okay. I hope in about an hour from now we're eating cake and drinking punch.
All right. As Jason Robinson comes up, I'll just mention to the public that as they're in the front, there's some cards to be able to fill out if you'd like to comment. If you have a question, if you'd please come to the microphone at the front and state your name, and then we have these comment cards. If you have a comment, please fill one of those out and write down the number that you'd like to comment to, and if you'd bring that up here to the front to Chris. We'll give 3 minutes to individuals and 5 minutes to a group organization. With that, we'll turn the time over to Jason.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jason Robinson, the Upland Game Coordinator out of our Salt Lake office. I'm going to be talking about upland game and turkeys tonight. So one of the things I do right up front is talk about how upland game are a little bit different. They are different from big game in almost every way, and so we manage them very differently. Upland game experience boom and bust cycles and are generally short-lived. Most species live less than 2 years. Populations are largely dependent upon annual production and less so on survival. Natural annual survival rates are low and can range between 10 and 40%. So to state that a different way, in a totally healthy pheasant population, 80% of the population can die each year, and then that the remaining 20% reproduces and offsets that loss. And so with that, hunter harvest generally accounts for less than 10% of the annual population variation. And so population cycle largely independent of hunter harvest. We term this the law of diminishing returns, which essentially is if a hunter goes out when the populations are high, has a great hunt, they're going to go back and tell their friends, and their friends are more likely to go out hunting. in years where the population is low because of weather or climate, that same hunter might tell his friends that hunting wasn't very good, so they're less likely to go out hunting. And so there's this inherent protection for those different species. We also like to have long season lengths and pretty general bag limits. So this spreads harvest and opportunity out in both time and space. So you'll see a lot of statewide hunts with long season dates for upland game. So what this all really comes down to is a three-year guidebook for upland game makes sense biologically. It also makes sense administratively. So one of the things, because it's a three-year guidebook that we're asking you to approve tonight, one of the things that happens is some of these hunts have a fixed opener date that potentially can fall on a Sunday. And because we can't open a hunt on Sundays here in Utah, what we are recommending is if it's scheduled a hunt to open on a Sunday, we just move it to the Monday following. So, for example, September 1st, 2019 is a Sunday. We would recommend opening that hunt on September 2nd. So we have 20 different species of upland game that we're going to be covering tonight. And so what I would like to do is I'll present each species, go pretty quickly on the species that we aren't recommending any changes, and then on species where we're recommending changes from the previous guidebook, I'll spend a little bit more time explaining that. So jumping right into it, California and Gamble's quail. We are not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a five daily bag, single or in combination. I guess one note for this region, scaled quail is a closed season. We do have scaled quail here in the southeast region, but that's a closed season. Gray and chukar partridge, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a five daily bag of each species. Ringneck pheasant. So this is one hunt that we are recommending a change. In the past, we've had a split season where we had a two-week season that was open statewide, and then following that, we had a two-week season that private lands were closed, public lands were open. And what we're finding is that's causing a lot of confusion for hunters, especially with some of our walk-in access properties that are private lands, but they are open to hunting during that later part. And so what we, Pheasants Forever approached us and asked us if we would look into changing this. And so our recommendation is to have just a statewide hunt from the first Saturday in November to the first Sunday in December. So no changes to the dates, but just make it a little bit simpler, a statewide hunt. And then keep the youth hunt and the bag limit of two males. Dusky and ruffed grouse, or our forest grouse, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a bag of four. Greater sage grouse, we're not recommending any hunts or any changes there. So we'd like to continue with a permit allocation system. Just to reiterate, most of the state is closed to sage grouse hunting with four areas open, and harvest is less than 3% of the statewide population. We'd like to continue allocating 15% to the youth. So those are the four areas that are open with a bag limit of two birds per year. So again, no recommended changes there. Sharptail grouse, we'd like to recommend no changes here as well. Continue with a permit allocation system with 15% of the permits going to youth. There's two areas open, no changes there, with a bag limit of two birds per year. Both of those hunts, the sharp-tailed grouse and the greater sage grouse, are a permit hunt where basically a hunter has to apply for a permit in the drawing. White-tailed ptarmigan, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a four daily bag. Wild turkeys. Wild turkeys are managed a little bit differently than other upland game. So one of the things that we look at for the spring turkey hunt, we look at these performance targets. So we have three performance targets that we evaluate each year. We look at the three-year average of hunter success. We want that to be greater than 20%. The three-year average hunter crowding index on a 1-5 scale, and we want that to be less than 4. And hunter satisfaction, again, on a 1-5 scale, and we want that to be greater than 2. So looking at the data from the past, The yellow line there are the total permits sold. You can see a trend over the last 4 years of an increasing number of permits sold. And then total harvest there is the black line. So you can see an increasing trend in total harvest as well. Hunter success, three-year average hunter success is 32.3%. So that's above the 20%. So that trigger has not been met. Hunter satisfaction is a 3.8. Again, that's above the 2, so that trigger has not been met. Hunter crowding is a 2.2, which is less than 4, so that trigger has not been met. And this graph's probably of interest. The green line there represents the number of hunters afield, and you can see over the last 4 years we've been increasing the number of hunters afield, but the hunters that are afield don't feel any more crowded. And there's probably a couple of reasons for that. Hunters are pretty good at dispersing themselves over the landscape, as well as an increasing turkey population. We have turkeys in more areas for hunters to go. So to kind of sum up all that information, hunters are being successful, they have high satisfaction, and they're not feeling very crowded. So based on that, those three things and conversations we've had with groups and hunters, the division is not recommending any changes to the spring wild turkey hunt. A hunter can have one permit, and we have a limited entry season that opens in April, and then we have a general statewide over-the-counter, so those permits are unlimited, basically the month of May. So again, no changes there. Moving into the fall wild turkey hunt. So the main objective of the fall wild turkey hunt is to reduce human-turkey conflicts. Certain parts of the state, the turkeys have done very well and come into conflict a little bit. So a fall hunt can actually reduce turkey populations. And so with this hunt, we like to be kind of more strategic and go into areas where the turkey population is too high, reduce that with hunter harvest, but still allow for other areas to grow turkey populations. And so we're not recommending any changes there. The system we have in place seems to be working quite well for that approach. Snowshoe hare, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a 5-daily bag. Cottontail rabbits, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a 10-daily bag. The falconry recommendation, we're not recommending any changes there. It's a 6-month season. So shifting gears just a little bit, so there are 5 migratory upland game species, and these species are a little bit different. They're managed through basically through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and through the federal government and the flyway process. So they're managed more like waterfowl than the species we just talked about. Those 5 species are band-tailed pigeon, sandhill crane, American crow, mourning dove, and white-winged dove. In addition to those additional requirements from the federal government, there's also a requirement to have a harvest information program number, a HIP number. And one of the things we wanted to do is, as an informational item within this presentation, is we're going to make some changes to the way hunters get their HIP number moving forward. So these numbers are required for the 5 migratory upland game birds, waterfowl, and geese. And so what we're going to do is move to an online system so a hunter can get their HIP number on their smartphone in the field or on their home computer. And it will take effect this fall. And what it's going to essentially do is make it much faster and easier for hunters to be able to get that HIP number. So moving into the recommendations for the migratory birds, band-tailed pigeon, we're not recommending any changes there. A hunter must obtain a free band-tailed pigeon permit. It's a statewide hunt with a 2-daily bag. Sandhill cranes, we're not recommending any changes for 3 of the hunts, the Rich, Cash, and East Box Elder. We are recommending a change for the Uinta County hunt. We talked to folks out there, and the cranes in that part of the state seem to arrive in October as opposed to September. And so they felt like moving it back into October would benefit the landowners as well as hunters. So we're recommending a season date change. We're recommending 3 separate seasons, 10 days each, with the first opening on the Saturday closest to October 1. The bag is 1 per year. Mourning and white-winged dove. We're not recommending any changes there. It's a statewide hunt with a bag of 15. American crow, not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a bag of 10. Migratory upland game falconry, we're not recommending any changes there. We have two board action items that we would like to address in this process. The first one is the board asked us to look at youth hunts on WMAs for upland game. So we put together a full list of all the upland game youth hunting opportunities in the state, and that was provided in your RAC packet. And out of that, we have one recommendation for this RAC, is we are recommending closing the Pavant and Annabella WMAs, those are both in the southern region, to the general public on the second Saturday of November for a youth pheasant hunt. This is a hunt that's been going on for a number of years for the youth. Really hasn't been a conflict, but what we would like to do is just make it closed and make people aware through the guidebook and in public releases so an adult doesn't show up on the day that we're holding the youth hunt. The second board action item was to look at the order of the turkey hunts. Specifically, the board asked us to look at eliminating the limited entry turkey draw and replace it with all over the counter. As we talked about earlier, the division is not recommending any changes to the current turkey hunt structure. No management triggers have been met. As I've mentioned earlier, hunters are being successful. They're satisfied and they're not feeling crowded. So we're not recommending any changes there. A couple of housekeeping items. Rule 657-6, taking upland game. We made some minor editorial corrections and then made some corrections and clarifications on baiting upland game. Rule 657-54, taking wild turkeys. We made some minor editorial corrections and some corrections and clarifications on baiting wild turkey. And all that language was provided in your RAC packet. So that's everything I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Questions from the RAC?
Jason, what triggers do sagegrass have that allow a hunt to occur? What is there a population number or something that you reach?
Yeah, so for sage-grouse, the breeding population has to be greater than 500 adults.
And that's based on strutting ground counts with 2-to-1 ratio of male to female?
We've modified that a little bit from some of the research that's come out, and I'll have to look up the exact numbers. It's not quite a 2-to-1 ratio, but we assume that we count about 80% of the males on the lek, so we don't count them all. So we account for that, and then we generally don't count the females, so we also account for that. And it's about a 2-to-3 ratio is what the research is showing. But we have a population estimator that we use to determine that.
Okay, so it's a 2-to-3 ratio, but with a 20% add-on to the male total?
Correct. It's a little more exact than that, but that's off the top of my head. That's
okay. On the turkey, well, I guess on your first discussion on the upland game, you indicated that hunters account for only 10% of the mortality on upland game. And would that hold true with turkeys as well?
Yeah, for the most part. We try and it's probably actually less than that because the hunt in the spring is essentially a male-only hunt. And so you have a sex ratio skew for turkeys as well, so you have more hens than you have females than males. And so we probably harvest less than 10% of the turkey population.
Okay, and just so you know where this question's going, If you did have a fall turkey hunt, would it still be 10% of the population?
With the fall turkey hunt that we've implemented and we're recommending here, what we do is we give the region the opportunity to evaluate that situation and use that hunt as a kind of a strategic way to reduce those turkey conflicts. And so we actually have a little bit of variation in there on how much of the population we want to remove. We can try and just stabilize the population. If the landowners in the area are okay with the current population, we'll try and stabilize it. Or we can increase harvest to try and reduce that population as well, based on what the region feels and the needs of the landowners.
Okay. And in states that do have a fall turkey hunt, is that 10% of the population? Or is that, I mean, what I'm asking is, we don't really have a fall turkey hunt. We have a turkey depredation hunt in the fall, is what, I mean, it's not a true fall turkey hunt.
Well, we have both. We do have a fall depredation hunt that's separate from the turkey hunt that we're recommending here, which is a fall general season that's more strategic and precise. And each region has the ability to implement that fall hunt if they need to.
Based on depredation issues, so correct?
Yes, not specific human-wildlife human-turkey conflict.
All right, yeah, okay. So states that have an over-the-counter fall turkey hunt, would they be reducing populations? I mean, is 10% what you'd expect to reduce the population by with that kind of hunt?
You know, there's so much variation between states and number of hunters, number of turkeys. I probably couldn't comment on if those hunts would affect the turkey population.
Okay. And if Utah ever got to the point where hunter satisfaction hit your trigger points, would you consider a fall turkey hunt to reduce the number of, so that you could only have one turkey permit a year and you had to pick a fall or a spring permit? Would that be a strategy you would look at?
Yeah, if we hit one of those triggers, what we would essentially do is probably convene a committee together to look at which trigger we hit, why we possibly hit that trigger, and then we would look at all options to address that, which obviously a spring and fall dynamic would play into that.
Okay. I'm just kind of, I'm of the opinion that, well, we'll get into that in comments, sorry. Okay, thank you.
Jason, there at the end you had a slide that that commented on the limited entry for the turkey hunting. Can you comment on that further, the possible elimination of the limited entry portion?
Yeah, so I wasn't at the board meeting that this was put on the action log, so I don't have a full reference of what it was. But the board wanted, it was kind of in light of some of the conversations with youth hunting and opportunities for youth. And so they wanted us to look at the possibility of changing the way the spring hunt's structured and maybe eliminating the limited entry and swapping it out for a total over-the-counter. And so with that action log, we went and met with a variety of different folks, got their input, looked at all of our management triggers, all the data we had, also dug into the literature a little bit. And one of the things, not only is the hunter triggers haven't been met, but we also looked at the literature. And having an over-the-counter hunt in April in Utah probably isn't a real good recommendation because it could disrupt some of the nesting behavior. If you limit that opportunity, you can still have fewer hunters out there and allow for that. But if you went strictly over the counter, it could disrupt some of that. There's also evidence that illegal incidental take of hens in April could have an effect. So there's both social and biological reasons to keep the current structure that we have.
Okay. And so have you taken that action log back to the Wildlife Board?
We will. In June, we're presenting it to all the RACs, and then we'll present it to the board.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the RAC?
Yeah. One last question. What was the sage-grouse strutting ground male count this year for what's our sage-grouse management area, Emma Park? Is that what it's called, Emma Park?
There's the carbon.
Carbon, okay. Yeah. Yeah. What was the total males counted?
I don't have that data yet. If I don't know if Guy has it.
I don't have the actual numbers. I know down from last year, and last year was an all-time high. And even though it's down slightly, it's still high numbers of what we've had.
So do you know what last year's was?
The total count for Emma Park? I don't.
Is there a way you can get that number?
Yeah.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, any other questions from the... seeing none, we'll go to questions from the audience. Okay, yeah, please come to the microphone and state your name.
Deward Patterson. I'm a falconer, and one of my favorite prints is one from King Frederick from the Holy Roman Empire, and it happens to have a falcon, a peregrine in this case, stooping on a heron. And when you brought up the thing that falconry is excluded from the sandhill crane, I was wondering why. What's the rationale in back of that?
So sandhill cranes are managed through the flyway system, so they're a federally regulated species. And so in federal rule, it states what species are allowed to have falconry. So sandhill cranes are not included with that.
Okay, so it's from the federal. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And any other questions from the audience? With that, we'll go to comments from the audience. Rick Britton.
My name is Rick Britton. I'm the regional director for the Wild Turkey Federation here in Utah, Colorado and Nevada. Thank you guys to the RAC, and thanks, Jason and the division. We support our board, and our members support Jason and the division on their no change to the spring or fall turkey program. Okay, so appreciate that and appreciate all the work they put into it and what you guys are doing. So thank you.
Thank you, Rick. That's my last comment card. Any other comments? Okay. We'll go to back to comments from the RAC.
I guess my comment on the fall turkey hunt is, does the division not feel that the population can take a 10% additive mortality on the population by allowing at least a limited entry hunt? It seems like we could. There's a lot of people that are on the spring hunt that need to be on the fall hunt, because the kind of hunting they like to do on the spring hunt is sneak up on them and chase them and run them around. And there's a segment of upland game hunters out there with good bird dogs that would like to bust up a brood of turkeys and use their dog to try to hunt a turkey. I'm just curious why Utah has been so hard to get around to a fall turkey hunt. And if we had one turkey per hunter per year, those people that decided they wanted the fall hunt was a better situation to them would take them out of the spring hunt, clearing an area for less crowding, although it looks like hunters are perfectly satisfied with the crowding. But if we ever get to that point, I would hope Utah would look at that as a solution to get some of the spring hunters out of the spring hunt and put them in a fall hunt. If maybe Jason or Guy could just kind of address what their concerns are with going to a true fall turkey hunt, not a fall turkey, let's help the human turkey interaction, then I'd like to hear their reasons for why we're so hard to convince to go that way.
So I think the short answer to that is we're still trying to grow turkeys here in Utah, and fall hunts can stop or reduce population growth. And so we don't want to implement that in areas that we are still trying to grow turkey populations. And there are numerous places throughout the state of Utah that we're still trying to grow turkey populations. So that's the main justification. And just to clarify, the recommendation does allow for a fall turkey hunt. We are recommending a fall turkey hunt. It's up to the region to decide if they want to implement it in the southeast region and where. So that is an option currently being recommended.
Okay, so what I'm getting from that is the southeast region has elected not to recommend a fall turkey hunt?
Correct.
Okay.
We do have other regions that do have, the northern region and the southern region both have fall turkey hunts currently.
And those are fall turkey hunts designed to reduce turkey-human interactions, or they have plenty of turkeys so they want to have a fall turkey hunt?
It's probably more in the human turkey conflict arena, but it is a pretty large opportunity for a number of hunters in areas where the populations are fairly large and can sustain that kind of harvest.
Okay. And maybe a question for Guy is, how many more turkeys in Caneville do you hope to see?
We actually, I'm still waiting to hear back. We haven't made that recommendation for a fall hunt yet, but I've been talking to Wade about that. We are considering that for Caneville for a fall hunt. It's one of the areas we'd look at that. On the sage-grouse counts, last year at Emma and Whitmore, we were 115 was the high last year. We were at 95 this year. At Schofield, we were 75 last year and 55 this year.
Any other comments?
Let me do some math.
Jason, I had the opportunity to sit on the statewide turkey committee that you hosted, and one of the things my eyes were really open to was the amount of turkeys that are in portions of the state. Absent to that was a large part of southeastern Utah compared to the other parts of the state. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Again, the short answer is habitat. Along the Wasatch Front, there's a lot more water, which means a lot more vegetation, tree canopy, which is very important for turkeys, as is food. Gamble's oak is a very important tree species here in Utah for wild turkeys as a food source. They also require roosting trees. So a lot of game birds sleep on the ground. Turkeys sleep up in trees. And so they need large, mature trees. And the most common species here in Utah are cottonwoods and ponderosa pine. So really it comes down to lack of water, which equals lack of habitat. We've been trying to move birds here into the region in areas where we have habitat. Even some of the other regions, bringing turkeys into the southeast region to try and increase those populations. Thank
you. Okay, I did my math. We're below the 500 that triggers a hunt. And I guess my question to the division is the year that mathematical model reaches 500 population, is that you guys going to recommend a hunt, or due to the situation of sage grouse, or probably no new hunts for sage grouse in Utah?
So we've had these conversations for other populations in the state. One of the things that we try not to do is open a sage grouse hunt. So sage grouse populations naturally cycle up and down, and it's about an 8 to 9 year cycle between high and low, then low again. What we're seeing is we're coming off of probably we haven't got the numbers for this year, but last year and the year before were population highs. The last time before that was 2006, so this was the next population high. We're likely to start seeing a population decline. And so one of the things we're very sensitive to is having a population high that meets this threshold, opening a hunt, and then that population falling below that threshold. And so all the populations that we currently hunt are above that threshold in both the high and the low years, just to make sure that we're not doing any kind of damage to that population. So to sum that up is we try and be very conservative with sage grouse hunting.
Okay. Thanks, Jason.
Entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to accept the plan as provided or put forth.
Got a motion by Darrell Meekham to accept the Upland Game and Turkey Hunt recommendations as presented. Second by Charlie Tracy. All in favor? Unanimous. All right, we'll go to the falconry rule.
Good evening. My name is Russ Norvell. I'm with the non-game avian program coordinator in Salt Lake, and this is my first RAC tour, and the first time the falconry rules probably come before most of you. I think the last time it went out was over 6 years ago, which is a little bit longer than we'd have liked. But here we go. It's a long and somewhat complicated rule. A little background first. The sport of falconry is the sport of kings. It's been practiced for thousands of years on most every continent. In Utah currently, to give you a sense of scale, we have 253 permitted falconers in the state with about 276 individual birds, representing roughly 26 raptor species. 16 of these species are native to North America. 10 are either non-native or hybrids. Five of those 26 are also considered to be conservation status species. So they're either a threatened endangered species, they're a state-sensitive species, a conservation agreement species like the northern goshawk with the Forest Service, or they're a bird of conservation concern for the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is their de facto candidate species list, essentially, that we need to respect. About half of those are captive bred, so a lot of these are not necessarily wild-caught. So the states were granted authority to administer the falconry rule by the federal government in 2008. Federal rule is quite a general, sort of one-size-fits-most approach, as it has to cover the entire nation. States are given the authority to deal with specific local issues as needed. And as I mentioned, this rule has not been revised in over 5 years. Am I like blasting you guys out of here? It seems like it's awfully loud. And we have got some new conservation needs that have come up in that time, and we've also had some resolved conservation concerns we can address. Utah's primary purpose of the falconry rule is to govern the take of protected wildlife, including the collection and possession of falconry birds and the take of game animals. This is defined in rule as caring for and training raptors for the pursuit of wild game and for hunting wild game with raptors. Possession of non-suitable raptor species is typically governed by the CIP rule, which is a sister rule. It's the collection, importation, and possession rule. And this is probably, we're probably going to touch on this again later, because this is how we define the sport of falconry. This rule presentation covers three primary themes. There's the hunting with raptors, take of raptors from the wild, and also the care of raptors. But the rule itself also covers a variety of other activities, including the importation of non-native species into the state. This is actually, you can import species of falconry that are prohibited by other rules. It also covers abatement activities, so the use of falcons to at airports, for example, so we're sanctioning a business practice with this rule. It also covers captive propagation, where you capture birds from the wild and then can use their progeny as a business. You can sell those, even though the wild-caught raptors remain wild in theory. So hunting with raptors. Raptors are defined as a type of allowable weapon, although it's a type of allowable weapon that has their own constituency. If you're in any weapon deer hunt, maybe no one cares which rifle you use. In this case, there's a constituency that cares which falcon you use, perhaps. But the rule does allow for the take of protected game species, primarily Jason's World, the upland and game, and the waterfowl, but also allows for take of unprotected species and for the creation of special seasons for falconry, special hunting seasons for falconry meets. These are ad hoc seasons. Take of wild raptors for falconry is also limited or governed by a number of other state and federal rules and laws. There's the federal falconry rule itself, also the Endangered Species Act, however, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, the Federal Birds of Conservation Concern List. I should also mention the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and also by tradition and history, the falconer experience level, and more recently, state conservation concerns have become folded in. The care of raptors is also covered by this rule. There's a large section that's virtually taken directly out of the federal standard. Standards for care, standards for facilities, and for when and where facilities inspections can take place. Given that many raptors are housed inside people's residences, this is an area that we need to cover in detail. The sport of falconry in the current rule has, and also by the federal rule, has three experience classes. There's the apprentice, typically allowed one bird, typically of one of a few species, and only adult birds. This is a three-year apprenticeship. The general class has allowed three birds with many more species and many more ages as well. There's a five-year duration to that. And then a master, is once they've graduated from these other classes, can have multiple birds of any authorized species. The asterisk is for golden eagles. Under the current rule and state and federal rule both, golden eagles are allowed for falconry for master class with a special, we've been calling it an eagle endorsement. In this rule proposal, however, this endorsement has been expanded to include a variety of other similarly large and difficult to handle raptors of a similar scale. You have to have letters of recommendation, experience handling these birds and caring for them. This list of authorized species is going to come up in detail tonight, and it's important for lots of reasons, legal reasons, conservation reasons, and for some practical ones as well. The current rule has some issues. It is actually got some flaws to it. As I mentioned, it's based largely on the federal standard. This was kind of a one-size-fits-some approach. And that's what we inherit. That's the basement. We can be more restrictive, but we can't be more liberal than the federal rule. As a result, our state rule is currently long and complex and unique, in that it uses native and non-native birds to take protected wildlife. It allows the possession of non-native species that are otherwise prohibited by the CIP rule, which is essentially respecting international threatened or endangered status, if you will. It allows the take of high-priority conservation species from the wild, which nobody else gets to do. And it allows for special ad hoc licenses, locations, and seasons, which, as defined by the director and the Wildlife Board. So our goals here were to invite the public into the process and have sort of a no-surprises approach. And we'll cover that. We also intended to simplify the rule, to clarify the language and intent, and ideally to shorten it. I think we fell a bit short of that goal. But ultimately, to make it easier to use, both for falconers to comply with and the public, but also for enforcement and for administration as well. In public engagement, we have worked with falconers and the Utah Falconry Association actively since last July. We've had three open houses, over 10 other meetings with the Utah Falconer Association and other falconers. We have addressed well over 60 specific issues at this point. We have addressed issues in particular with administrative procedures as well that don't actually are not in this rule but evolved out of those discussions as well. So this is a result of considerable consultation. We've responded to literally hundreds of comments in the process. Again, our goal was to simplify this overall. We've clarified language and intent, so if you've looked at the red line copy of the rule, it is full of red, and this is why. We've grouped like sections to streamline the rule. We've rewritten whole sections to clarify the intent. We've updated the references to match the Fish and Wildlife Service's Birds of Conservation Concern list, the BCC list. This is important for us because we had 11 species in the 2008 BCC federal list. In the draft that was finalized in 2016, routed internally for Fish and Wildlife Service review, and then has had state review in 2016, we approved that list, and we're looking forward to having that approved. That's sitting in D.C. now waiting approval. So until that goes through, we're all kind of waiting for their shoe to drop there. We've also updated references in this rule to the upland game and pen-reared bird rules to make sure that we're all on the same board. Same page there. Ultimately, we wanted to make it easier to use. Again, we've clarified processes and lines of authority by updating administrative processes and methods. Primarily, we've built a database. Some basic things hadn't been happening before, so we've corrected the contact list. We've added emails. We can actually reach out to falconers directly. We've updated all our forms and going to get those ready for web applications. We've also added language to protect falconers in case of a state change in a bird status, so if it gets listed as a T&E species later, they're not in trouble. We've added take of adult American kestrels, which is allowed by federal rule for master and general class falconers, because our current rule, which separates those, is both hard to comply with and hard to enforce, frankly, because they're adult haggard and passage birds, the breeding adults versus the first-year migrants, are difficult to discern visually. We've also clarified the authority as to that only the division director and wildlife board in the new rule have authority to make changes. In the current rule, the program director is inappropriately specified. So in sum, with small changes, we've initially had shortened the rule by over 5 pages. I think the last round of edits before you got your redline copy added some. There are over 80 edits and corrections to clarify intent, to update citations, to fix confusing sentences. The biggest one, though, and the one we're going to touch on most and later here in the discussion, is that we incorporated the pre-authorized species list, the species you can use for falconry, from a table that had sat on the website beside the rule but was not incorporated into the rule itself text. That's to comply with current construction of rules, the standards for the state. And that has sparked a great deal of controversy as we go. We've also restructured sections to strengthen and simplify as best we can. All of these changes are setting us up for some changes that are not in the rule itself. So shifting to online, life online, basically. We're shifting to online COR application process, adding falconry CORs to the DWR mobile app, shifting to online annual reporting, and all of this connected to the falconry database, which is finally up on its feet. The big changes, however, are that we are increasing the number of pre-authorized species. The current rule has no list incorporated into rule. It has that table that sits beside it, and it specifies 14 native species. It is vague at best on what to do with hybrids and captive-bred non-natives, exotics. The federal rule allows any of three families of hawks, eagles, and falcons. Most of these globally are non-native. There are over 500 across the world. Our proposal pre-authorizes 32 non-native species and 23 native species and defines a process by which more may be added by simple request. We can cover how we got to that number if you'd like. We've reduced the waiting period also for peregrine falcon and sensitive species permits from 3 years to 2. And we've allowed the eagle endorsement, the special endorsement for large raptors, to be offered to general class falconers as well for large non-native species, not the golden eagle, however, which is precluded by federal rule. So the changes to the pre-authorized species list. Our current rule, in policy and practice, although it will be pointed out later that the rule is improperly constructed, and so it's probably tenuously enforceable. This is one of the problems with our current rule. This is one of the things we're trying to fix. We currently allow 14 species of natives, North American native species, for apprentices. The proposed rule would increase that to 15. For general, we'd go from 14 species to 44. From master, from 15 to 45. And the eagle endorsement was only offered for golden eagles for masters, and then would be allowed for 11 species of large raptors, generally speaking eagles, eagle class, I think aircraft carriers or anything, for either generals or masters. So I will emphasize that this is one slide that was not in the original packet because we've been responding to some questions that have come up in the prior racks and wanted to help give you some better information to start. Let me emphasize, though, that the proposed rule has not changed. That has not changed. I just added a couple of slides here to help clarify some questions. So why do we need a list? Fundamentally, we have two overlapping rules, the CIP rule and the falconry rule, which allow and disallow the same species. So we need to have a clear, bright line for which species are allowed for falconry. It also allows the division an opportunity to minimize risks, both from disease, wildlife diseases, ecological impacts from escape birds potentially, legal and human health and safety issues as well, since some of these are very large raptors, 12-foot wingspans can carry 40 to 60 pounds. And fundamentally, though, we're looking to have a list of pre-approved list of species that are deemed suitable for falconry, such that nocturnal insectivorous owls, which are also raptors under the federal rule and potentially allowable, are not suitable for hunting wild game, nor are colonial nesting carrion eating birds, for example, your vultures. So we were asked to clarify how would new species be added. In the proposed rule, it simply states that the division director will evaluate a new COR and make a recommendation. We want to flesh that out with the process, which we use to get to our current list of proposed 54. Is a species suitable for falconry? Can you hunt wild game with it by state definition? If yes, go on to the next. Does it pose a risk to human health or safety? Again, some of these are very large, potentially dangerous birds. There's also the question of importing diseases from around the world. And the third part is that if this species escapes into the wild, can it establish a viable population or hybridize with native species of concern? Currently, these latter two criteria are not high on our list. These are all criteria we wanted to use to make sure we were doing our due diligence. And with that, I'll take any questions.
I'll feel lost next time I come. See you guys.
See ya.
See you, Darren.
Thanks.
Russ, how many permits does a state issue on an annual basis for taking young out of the nest for falconry purposes?
That's hard to determine right now. I'd have to look that up. We've just got this database built, and some of the weakest data is the capture permit data, which oftentimes capture permits are issued, and then we don't find out until the next annual report if they were used and for what species, where, and for what age. So that's because the federal what's called the 3-186 database, it's the federal form that's required that we basically get a copy of that same information. That database has been down for almost over a year now. So reporting has been sketchy, quite honestly. It's My gut feeling is going to be in the low double digits.
Okay. And you have to issue a COR for that as well?
Correct.
How many CORs do you issue?
Again, new ones, low double digits. There's many more renewals. Most falconers, because it's a very large investment in both time and facilities and lifestyle, really, folks who get into falconry stick with it for a long time. So it's not a fast-growing sport by any stretch. You get a surge in applications for apprentices after, you know, a new documentary showing whatever eagles in Kazakhstan or something, but that fades pretty quickly. A lot of those folks don't stick with it because it's a real lifestyle, a real commitment. So falconers are a devoted bunch.
Any other questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? Please come up and state your name.
Hi, my name is Todd Ballantyne. I come from Salt Lake down here. I am with the Utah Falconers Association and representing tonight. Just a few questions. To help clarify. So when the rule was updated in 2010 when it became available here from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Utah followed the historical pattern that they had done in the past for allowing all of the falcons and hawks and eagles. There were only a couple owls, like 285 birds. And then in 2010, it went up to nearly 500, which Russ said. And all of those birds are currently authorized for use, right, Russ?
The 500 birds, as I mentioned in the presentation, there's a list of 14 allowable native species for native to North America species that are allowable for falconry. However, because of rule construction, that's very likely to be unenforceable, and which would backstop us to the federal rule, which is the three orders of anything that goes worldwide.
So those 14 or 15 birds prior to 2010 were listed in the existing falconry proclamations under capture, correct?
I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and take a look at the earlier proclamations.
I have an example, but it was prior to 2010. The two lists that we're talking about now existed for decades, I assume decades, but for a long time in the proclamation then for wild take, and there was no, and it was a concurrent list with all of the order stuff, the 285 birds, so it was never intended to be a limited list. It was what's available for wild take. And then, go ahead, Russ.
Intent. When he did speak to I did speak with the prior falconer coordinator who was in charge of the rule revision the last time, and it was the intent of the coordinator and the Salt Lake staff, that was their understanding, that list of 14 was to be the list of allowable species. Its construction is flawed, however, and it's unclear as to how hybrids and exotic species were to be handled.
So my use of the word intent meant when it was used prior to 2010. There was never any intent prior to 2010 to separate the 14 birds from the rest of the allowed things because it was there forever, you know, rule after rule.
I can't. Our record keeping is probably not as good as it could have been in terms of how the intent behind earlier rule constructions. So a lot of maybe the best notes weren't kept. We don't actually have. I don't have any real documentation to say what the intent was prior to 2010.
When the new rule was being made, and we were working with Jim Parrish, the list of captured birds wasn't incorporated into the rule. The feds didn't have it. We were following the federal language pretty exactly to protect us. And that language references threatened and endangered species and sensitive species and BCC and the different orders. And we wanted to have a clarifying list of what could be possessed. And that summarize the ones that were local, and then there were the feds don't even take care of exotics, you know, and it wasn't in there.
But just one thing. Do you have any other questions? Or
I do.
Okay.
I do. The point with the list that we're, and thanks for clarifying. So the point with the list was that, to help clarify, and I was there with Jim when we did it, and he's contacted Jim, but let me ask some questions. So right now we're able to have 500 lists, and according to me that was by intent and not that way. The division had said that we were going from 14 to 52, which was a 300% increase in allowed birds, but really aren't we going from 500 to 50-something, which is a 90% decrease in allowed birds right now?
In our policy and practice, we have been using the list of 14 as the list of allowed species. So from our perspective, we are going from 14 to something more than that. The list of 54 came from discussions with UFA where they objected to this the same premise. And our response was to say, well, what do you want? What are the common birds that are used for falconry that we should include? Let's make sure they get on the list too. And that's where you got a proposed list of from UFA of 74 species. They were evaluated through using a process that's right there. Basically, we had to make sure they were legally possessable and legally possessed. We wanted to make sure they were suitable for falconry as the state defines and is authorized to regulate falconry, i.e. insects and carrion are not wildlife, not wild game, and nocturnal species are not especially well-established, not well-suited for use in falconry. We also had a number of risk assessment factors, conservation status, risk to human health and safety, potential for establishment, and consequences of establishment. These are the same factors that are going to come before this group when the CIP rule is proposed for revision, given that the underpinning for when and where or why species are allowed into the state, exotic species, needs to have a common foundation between state rules. We can't have a patchwork. That's where this risk assessment protocol came from. And for falconry issues, there's not a lot of risk associated. It's a very low risk of establishment for raptor birds. For raptors, they have to find a suitable mate, similar habitat, et cetera. And we don't have sister species that are of conservation concern, like in Alaska, where you can't have a goshawk escaping because you've got a conservation concern subspecies on living on an island. You don't want to dilute the genetics there. Otherwise, you get in trouble with the feds. And again, the other portion was that we have other pathways to possession for species that are not suitable for falconry, but people want to possess. There's the CIP rule itself, which has a variance process. It's much more onerous than the falconry rule, which is kind of a simple process by director approval. So,
I lost it in one of the train of thoughts or question. So when you, if Greg Hansen was here, would he say that the rule now is authorized to possess 500 birds?
Yeah, I think Greg is our assistant AG who's been working very closely with us and myself to rewrite this rule. He's probably the co-author of all this. It is legally tenuous right now. Our current rule is probably not enforceable for these 14 species, which puts us into an awkward situation that we're trying to reconcile with this rule.
Does 90% approximately of the rest of the United States allow the federal standard?
I can't speak to the entire United States. I did survey the 11 western states and the Pacific Flyway, and we're in the middle ground for that. There are some states, such as Arizona, which have basically adopted the federal rule and have no other stipulations. Other states, such as Alaska, Montana, California, have more or less strict limits on which species are allowable for falconry, what age classes, what areas of the state are allowable for take, et cetera. So we're kind of in the middle of that group.
And I do agree that Montana and Alaska have restrictions. When we look through the rest of the United States, we were finding the federal language in their rules. And Montana has a federal language but references outside of the falconry rule a restriction. So it's not the falconry rule. you know, per se.
The combination of rules and falcon for Montana, as I understand it, effectively prohibit the use of exotic and non-native raptor species being imported into the state.
And my point is that the majority of the United Nations follows this. We would be an abnormal pattern with the rest of the nation if we didn't follow the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Standard. I think during this presentation, the biological evidence of invasive species or genetic integrity is a minimal at this point in the RAC process. Is that right? Did I hear you say that that's not a grave concern?
That's not. Yeah, I would agree that the concern for Utah species of an escaped hybrid or exotic species establishing itself or corrupting, Utah genetic is not. Not an especially high risk for us, so it's not a great concern for us.
So. Nor safety.
Safety is something that we considered, given this is one of the species. This is a harp eagle that would be authorized. We had the criteria that we were proposing using both for this rule and for the CIP rule to come does incorporate risks to human health and safety. So risks not only to the falconer or the caregiver, if you will, but also to if the bird escapes, which happens commonly in falconry, and if someone goes to pick this up off the soccer field, what are the risks to that? Overall, though, the risks to human health and safety, we erred to the side of sportsman opportunity, since the division really is an agency devoted to increasing opportunity when possible. We erred to that side.
And in your experience or awareness for any birds that have had a safety issue in the past, that's even with eagles being flown?
Not to my knowledge. I cannot say that I have ever delved into the literature, though, to take a look.
I've never heard of one for a big thing like that. I mean, somebody might have an imprint bird not like them, but that's just what that is. When you went through the criteria for approving a bird, that's not in rule, and so would that be uniformly done and controlled as it stated? So what would stop? I mean, what would stop an approval of a bird? What were the other birds stopped for that were out of the 74? And I don't know what they were.
Oh, they were, detritivores, they were nocturnal insectivorous owls.
Oh.
They were arm candy.
Okay.
Honestly, God, falconry birds.
And some of the birds that we're prohibiting are specifically allowed in other states' rules. They don't get into the.
Correct. It's other states like Arizona don't regulate the species at all. They just step out of it. This is a relatively small program.
Yeah.
150-ish. And an extremely small budget for administration. So,
would you agree that when an art is practiced, that finding new avenues of expression in the art is a viable thing in art, and that by making what some would say arbitrary decisions about what can be flown or not, like little kestrels and insectivore, and owls are flown in the daytime, and little owls could be flown, and part of the federal language for defining falconry is caring for and other aspects besides hunting. And when apprentices start, they're using a kestrel, they're really not going to be hunting quarry. They're insects and mice, and they could go for a starling if they got skilled. They're learning about raptors, is what I'm saying. And so
we're at the 5 minutes. Maybe wrap up your questions.
For the questions? I didn't know that there was a limit on the questions for that stuff.
If I take your question, Todd, you're highlighting, I think, the inherent tension between the purview of the state and the Division of Wildlife to regulate a sport related to take of protected wildlife and the broader concept of what falconry is to falconers. And we don't, the Division of Wildlife, regulate sort of the art form of falconry. We establish a rule that allows for the pursuit of the sport as defined in state rule, where that's the limit of our purview. Beyond that, I think that's where some of the challenge to definitions comes in, and I understand that people do things like microfishing now. They're looking for diversity of tiny little minnows and things, and that's not really covered in our rules very well. This is, if someone wants to fly a tiny owl on moths at night, that might be fun, but it's not falconry as we define it.
But it would be in.
We're authorized to regulate.
Yeah, but it would fit in with the federal rule, I mean federal language of a definition. So I'll quit for time. I want to tell you that I appreciate the time that the division has given with us to resolve things. I appreciate Russ's efforts. He's put a lot of work into the rule this past year. Everything hasn't always been peaceful, but Russ is a good guy that really tries to interface with us well, and we've appreciated their interaction with us and get to the other parts.
So we'll go to, we're still on questions, but we don't have any comment cards for this section, so if you have some, please bring those up. Again, if you have a question, please come to the microphone and state your name.
Deward Patterson. Let me just again agree with what Todd has said, that this isn't, we're not here to beat up on Russ tonight. And I have all kinds of admiration for the law enforcement and that. My dad, in fact, held badge number 16. And so it's been a long extended. I have been in falconry since I was age 13. I didn't go out and fly with King Frederick, but I came close to it, even though that was a thousand years ago. Some people think I started before then. But my first question, could we go back to the allowable species according to your chart?
Just the slide you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Here, again, it says current rule, they're allowed 14. It's already been suggested, I think, that this was the take of native species in Utah. So, Russ, my question is, how many species are currently held? Are there more than 14 that are held by falconers in the state of Utah?
Yes, there are. The rule, the 14 species, is most clear. That table is most clear about take of native species. It does have a line saying that exotic and hybrid species are also allowed by approval by the program coordinator, and several species were, in fact, over time approved. Raptors are very long species, very long-lived species, so most of those approvals occurred quite some time ago, and I don't actually have the records of exactly when they occurred. There are some differences between what falconers sometimes recognize species that are not recognized by taxonomists. There are color morphs or regional variations that are commonly referred to in the falconry literature, but are not recognized by systemicists anyway. So there are some differences there, but they're small for the most part.
But there are a number of falconers that are holding species today that you're saying basically they're illegally held then?
No. They have legally approved CORs, and the current rule has language in it to grandfather anything that's currently approved into the future.
Okay. I'm concerned about the impact on some of the small communities that we have where we often hold meets. We have national meets. We have regional meets that are here from some of the states, and it can have significant economic impact on a community. If we are then going to exclude, is this correct, falconers coming in with species that are not on or allowable?
Actually, there is a slide left. The question of the NAFA meets, the North American Falconry Association meets, which have originally come to Utah, typically vernal, about every 5 years or so, for the last 15 or so. I think last time they came, we issued 75 permits. So it's a traditional spot for falconry. And to ease concerns around bringing birds in from out of state or even internationally, there's meets and trials. So trials are flying birds in an organized group on non-protected wildlife, so pen-reared birds, pigeons, that sort of thing, versus a meet, which is allows the take of protected wildlife, requires a special hunting license, which was a wildlife board action and has now, in this rule, become a director-level approval. So that's starting to ease the process there. We've also added a bulk approval option. So individual falconers can, as ever, just request an approval from the director, which would go through that same process we just outlined. There's also we've added a bulk approval option for meet organizers who, if they want to have individual falconers submit to them the list of birds they want to bring to Utah, if any of them are not on our current pre-approved list, those would be dealt with in a bulk fashion by the director. So to speed things up, make it easier.
So the harpy eagle that you saw there, I cannot hold, but somebody else could bring in.
No, the same rule set applies, actually. The same criteria for parity and equality issues. The same rule set would apply for both local and folks from away.
So other falconers in from other states cannot bring in their bird. Is that correct? If it doesn't meet our criteria.
If it's not on a pre-approved list, then they would need approval before they could bring it in.
Okay.
Just the same as a local falconer wanting to bring in a bird for personal use that was not on the pre-approved, they also would require a pre-approval. And as you mentioned, there are many birds already approved for use that are not on that list of 14 that have already secured approval.
Okay. How easy is it going to be to obtain approval if I want to fly one of those birds?
Well, we hope to make it clear, transparent, repeatable,
time.
All that, and this is the process that we've outlined. It's legally possessed, legally possessable, is it suitable for falconry, the risk assessment factors that are common to the CIP rule, and then if those things fail, then there's the other pathway to possession, which would go through the CIP rule itself.
So you've hit the 5 minutes. Please, if you can just wrap up your question.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Duard Patterson, followed by Todd Ballantyne.
Let me first state that I think when I first started falconry, there were no rules at all. And Utah has been really great in what they have done. When I went out, my biggest fear when I was a youth was having the bird shot off my fist, because there was actually a bounty on most of the birds that we were flying. We had no season for any bird other than the regular season. So if I wanted to go pheasant hunting, I had the 3 to 5 days at that point in time that you had. And so in general, falconry, it's been a tremendous improvement. And let me say again, with what Russ has come up with the proclamation here, we agree with virtually everything here with the one exception, and that is the list. And the list has no scientific basis whatsoever. There is no grounds for it on a scientific. It's strictly regulation, if you will. And then my question would be, how are they going to regulate it? Like I said, I come from a family where I've seen the law enforcement. I've dealt with it. Let me give you one example of what happened to me. At one point in time, we had to take every bird that we had down to the state to have them banned it. And I took my bird in, and I talked at that time about the number of Merlins that were out that year, that it was great. Now, I'm taking it down to North Temple at the time, right? Okay, and I'm taking it to the head of the falconry division. And we're having this discussion, and she bans the bird. And I go out to the lot, and I look at my paper, and they have identified the bird as a kestrel. The bird was a Merlin, and I had already gone through this. I have gone out, and I have helped train a number of law enforcement people in identification. They are not equipped to handle any change like this. I would plead that we stay with the federal laws that are there, that we match almost all of the other states with the exception of in the lower, as he mentioned, there's two others. We have Alaska that has a little bit different, and Hawaii doesn't allow any falconry whatsoever. But other than that, everybody is staying with the federal. There is no reason to go away with that. They have the experts. Every expert that we have sees no reason whatsoever to differ from that. Like I said, the rest of the proclamation, I think, is fine. I think that this will have impact. It's going to be more burdensome. We are already the most regulated of all sports. Nowhere else do you have to go through and take the exams, go through the apprenticeship program for the years that you have through that to get to a general, and then go through the general before you can become a master, and then even as a master before you can handle one of the larger raptors. It is the most highly regulated. We have people visiting to make sure that we have the correct facilities and everything else. I don't think you'll find a more dedicated group than falconers. Thank you.
Well, I got one question for you before you sit down, so that is your time. Being in the sport and dealing with it, what is your estimate of the number of people that would be outside of the law proposed today with species that they house in Utah?
Well, I think most of the list, and I don't know the exact, I know that their database, as they said, was not kept very well. So the question comes up with how many of the other birds are actually here right now. But I think, if I'm correct, wasn't most of the proposed list based on the fact of the birds that we currently have in possession, the 54 or whatever? I think there were a couple of exceptions to that. But
the list of 74 species that we got from the UFA were proposed because they were commonly used species or had been used, species that had been used for falconry. They were not specified because they were already here. Our list of 26 species that are currently in use, that is current. Those are the list. Those are the species. Those are the individuals and individual birds that are authorized through the COR. We're not offering an industry program. We're just... but we are offering in the language of the rule, grandfathering in of birds that may have been proved earlier under an earlier administration by a different director.
Okay.
But that's 26 plus the 14 that we could capture, plus whatever may not be on a COR that they're unaware of. Plus you've got people that are moving into the state. Do they have to give up their bird?
Yeah.
Because it's not on it.
Thank you. Todd?
Thank you. Todd Ballantyne, once again. Russ mentions grandfathering. We did ask for grandfathering, but there's an application for a new COR. It's not an automatic grant, is it? I mean, it's not. We asked for grandfathering, and that wasn't allowed.
Actually, Todd, that was one of the comments we responded to in the last red line. So we did actually include grandfathering in of birds that are approved under previous COR. Those species remain...
For NAFA meets, too?
That's one potential avenue to getting a bird approved on the pre-approved list.
So, okay. The North American Falconers Association has stated that they would remove Utah from the rotation of lists, and that does have an economic impact on the communities that come, and Vernal's there is the most recent one. The proposals that the division are making aren't based on biology. There's no evidence that they need it, and they admit that. There are additional hoops to go through to be able to retain a bird, and if you're not authorized to have the bird and it goes into this grandfather status, you can't hunt with it, I don't think. You can't. It's a fist ornament. You have to have facilities and expense to be able to accommodate another bird that would be legal. The Fish and Wildlife Service wasn't interrogated for loss data, which is very low, which we did. The premise for which it was given is to protect the wildlife from invasive species and genetic integrity loss, and those things are not high on their list anymore. And incorporating the list is. And the list that I've talked about shows that it wasn't ever in the past. It's not now. Everything's legal. There's not, there shouldn't be a situation where a bird should be in, basically, we're very opposed to this stuff because it hasn't made sense and it's evolved over time. And it's, the requirements have changed or been enhanced or the justification, it's kind of a moving target. And it's been frustrating to us. We recommend that which we propose there is that all aspects of the rule be accepted except for the list. It creates additional burdens and processes that aren't needed, and the amount of birds that were already on the books are most of what's going to be there, and people ought to be allowed to get other stuff without an arbitrary decision if it's a falconry bird or not, and the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't do it. We'd hope that you would go along with the preceding RACs and grant this request as we've requested it. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last comment card. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, seeing none, we'll go to comments from the RAC.
I guess my comment is there must be two Fish and Wildlife Services, because the Fish and Wildlife Service seems so liberal on this issue, but yet as a consultant working with oil and gas industry, if it's within a half a mile of an active nest, any disturbance at all has to be monitored by a biologist. The expense that goes in to energy development because of raptor nests, that to do these kind of mitigation things is crazy. And this other Fish and Wildlife Service, they seem to say you take any hawks, eagles, owls you want. And it just doesn't make sense to me.
Maybe it's just because there's not very many people wanting to do it. Because it's like you guys were saying, it's a lifestyle. It's like, to me, you got to live with these things pretty good.
Could I make just one comment? The falconers taking anything from the wild, okay, when what we're really talking about is others that are coming in private breeding, but of the 14 species that are allowed to be taken from the wild in Utah, they figure there's about a 75% mortality among raptors the first year. And you are only allowed to take a first-year bird because they figure that the chances of it surviving and in captivity is much greater. You cannot capture an adult bird from the wild. You can only take the first-year bird. So its chances of living are actually increased. And a lot of these birds that are taken, some falconers will fly them for a year, and then they release them, and so it actually increases the population.
Okay. Thank you. And I just need to reiterate, so now the time is closed to the public, but there may be questions from the RAC that we may call you up. So thank you. Other comments from the RAC? Dan, I can see that you've done a lot of studying on this, and I'm curious on your comments.
I don't know as if I have a comment. I guess I have a comment and a question. It sounds like there's been a lot of work put into this falconry rule, and at first glance, it seems like the list of species took into consideration the common birds that are used for falconry. And so I'm looking at this as, hey, there's a nice, easy, pre-approved list. These birds, 54 species, you know, people are very clear you can have them, go out and capture them. And then if you think you need something in addition, it sounds to me like you can ask for approval. Is that correct? So this list could expand,
yes.
Or you can get approval?
Yes, we anticipate this list will likely expand in the future.
Okay, and so that seems like that's adding just a list, like a second step. The division and other folks get a chance to review the species of interest.
Okay. And to add to Dana, just as I'm thinking as you stated it, so the 26 species that are currently known in the state, and is there any of those 26 that would not be approved by our 54 that are on this list?
No. They are all either already approved because of their current COR status. There's some hair splitting that goes on with the 26. Some of those are you lose the species concept when you start crossbreeding them,
uh-huh.
Right? So things get very mushy very quickly. So when you start counting the number of species, there's only a much smaller number of that. I have to look more carefully, but I'm guessing probably a lot fewer than 12 that are actual individual species. Then you got your crossbreeds, your uh-huh. your falcon peregrine falcon crosses, your Lanier deer falcon, your Merlin deer falcon, Barbary, et cetera, and goes down the list. But nothing that's currently held legally held in the state would be precluded under the rule.
Okay.
And did I also understand under this rule, if I read it right, that the general class, the restrictions on the general class are kind of reduced, so they're more similar to the master's class?
Correct. This was one of the points, one of the requests from UFA was to allow the general class falconer to seek the eagle endorsement, that special endorsement for large raptors. However, with the addition of the additional most of the large raptor species globally that were requested were these in this very large class of raptors. So functionally, this effectively erodes the difference between general and master class falconers in terms of the numbers of species allowable and age classes as well. So there, that is an outcome of this.
So the state of Utah, basically, what you're saying is you're trying to minimize the amount of species to take care of or to say is okay for reasons of management?
Because
I'm trying to get why you want to reduce the number.
Not so much reduce. The way the state rules are constructed are you can approach list making in a couple different ways. You can say everything's allowable except these things you don't want to allow in. But the way the state of Utah and the Division of Wildlife constructs rules, we have standards, we preclude everything. All weapons are off the table except rifles, et cetera, et cetera. But when crossbows are proposed or air rifles are proposed, they're not automatically allowed, and then we have to change the rule to preclude them, right? So that's the way state rules are constructed, and that's why we started with this list concept in the first place. We want to have a list of allowable weapon types, same as any other rule. That said, we did not set out to restrict opportunity, but rather to maximize it in a process that would not undermine other state rules, like the CIP rule, which regulates everything from kangaroos, I think, which have come before y'all, to anything else in the world that might be desire to be imported into the state.
So the question, so as I have listened to the comments tonight and to you, my understanding is such that many of the falconers under the old rule may have felt like that the list allowed them many more species, but at the same time, the species that are known and have been used are well within what you guys are recommending at this time.
Correct. I think if the rules dens, as it, in its currently probably unenforceable state, or were to go through, the actual number of species in captivity or in use for falconry wouldn't change very and probably wouldn't change very fast. I mean, even the acquisition of some of these exotic species is a time-consuming and expensive endeavor. People don't just on a whim go out and start with a, you know, harpy eagle. You've got to have one of the challenges for us is, of course, making sure that you've got, as folks have mentioned, the appropriate facilities. And in federal rule, we are required to make sure that the care and facilities for each of these species is appropriate. That's why it's, we have to have some, well, for law enforcement folks, some idea of what it is we're dealing with. 54 is a lot easier to deal with, frankly, than 500-something. I mean, I'm a credible raptor expert for the state of Utah, but I don't know. I am not a global raptor expert.
I don't know.
You guys just don't like a restriction of list. Is that basically what you're saying?
For example, this year a bird was seized for a few hours because they misidentified it. So now if you have this little list of birds compared to what you could have, now the COs have to know what something is so they can avoid a mistake like something that happened already this year, a real thing. The things they're talking about are theoretical. When he says that the state requires it by statute or by law to include lists, they are already included in what's there. They told us that, and it created great division among the falconry community. It was, they had to have an election in the club to have people come up to say, which position do you want to have represented at the racks? No list or a list. And it was no list by a slam dunk. And there was lots of things. There are inconsistencies, what Green said, that we don't have time to tell you here. That's why the other racks are saying not this. You know, it's just, it's not good.
I just have one comment, Kevin.
Speaking of the mic.
Fairly simple. I didn't know if I was close enough to it or not, but in most cases of regulation, my default position personally is the least restrictive rule is probably the one we ought to adopt.
That's what I was thinking, Kent. I was thinking the principle of this thing is government intrusion, is what these guys feel like, is they've gone from this 500 list and now all of a sudden they're getting cut back to, you know, and it's not, I mean, they only use 26 species, right, that we've got, but it's the principle of the government intrusion telling me what I can and can't do.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and that's hence my comment.
So I will make a motion that we accept the language presented by the Utah Falconers Association, the motion to accept all DWR changes to the falconry rule as presented, with the exception of the restrictive list of 54 raptor species, and instead of that list, retain the current Utah falconry rule permissive list of raptor species that has been in place since 2010 of any raptor species of the order, et cetera, et cetera. I'll give you the names so that you can spell them correct.
Yeah.
That's my motion.
Second. Okay, we got a motion by Todd Huntington to accept the division rule, except for the exception given us to by the Falconry Association. And that is seconded by Charlie Tracy. All in favor?
Uh-oh.
Okay. Opposed. Where's Daryl?
You get to break the tie, Mr. Chairman.
I'm not letting your last mic go down.
My last meeting.
Don't pull the goat one on us either.
And I have to make a decision.
What's it gonna be?
So with my decision, I'm gonna give a background. I by no means am a falcon expert, and I do I do hear the concerns of the Falconry Association. I can see that there's passion and that you guys do it as a sport. With that being said, I think that the division has put a lot of time into this rule, and they need a rule that when law enforcement goes out, that they it's clear to them, and they can manage, and it's something that they can stand on. I've seen a lot of times in big game when the rule is not clear, it's very hard to enforce. And so with that, I will vote nay. So the motion fails. And you guys can catch me at the door.
I'll make a motion that we accept the division's recommendation on the falconry rule as presented.
I second that.
Okay. We got a motion by Darius Jones to accept the Utah Division Falconry Rule as presented by the division and seconded by Chris Mikos. All in favor? Opposed? Man, I am earning my money tonight. So, nothing like going out on a big bang. So,
flip-flop on us.
I was going to say, let's see.
Yeah. So with that, I will vote for the motion. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adjourn.
With that, is there any other questions from the RAC? I would just like to state that I've been really appreciative to this RAC, and I feel like I've tried to pay attention to the other RACs and how they vote, and I sincerely say this when I say that I think that we have the most balanced RAC and that we've had very good discussion through the years, and I appreciate each of you for that. I really feel like each of you has represented your individual appointment very well, and with that, I really appreciate serving with you. We've had some really good discussions, so thank you for all of your time, and really appreciate serving with you. Thank you.